Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on our program today, electricity tariffs soar, now outpacing inflation threefold. The Tobacco Control Bill aims to cut smoking and curb illicit trade, but will it work? Tax changes make offshore investing more attractive to South Africans, and what seamless tech really means for SMEs. It's Tuesday, the 9th of September. Now, South Africans are being warned to brace for more electricity price shocks. Tariffs are now three times higher than the anticipated consumer inflation rate, with regulators' past errors compounding the problem and households already stretched to breaking point. Now, the hikes are raising tough questions about energy affordability, regulation, and also the broad pace of South Africa's transition. And I want to explore this in a little more detail. And joining me now is Professor Samson Mapweli, who's the head of the Energy Secretariat at the South African National Energy Development Institute. Professor, a very warm welcome. And how have we reached a point, in your opinion, where tariffs are rising three times faster than inflation?
So Eskom has been struggling with the tariffs for quite a long time. The Eskom tariffs have not been cost reflective. Basically, Eskom has been relying mainly on what many people call bailouts from government, which is the shareholder equity injection. So what happened in this time was that Eskom made a submission for the tariff hike to NERSA, and then NERSA granted them 12.74% for 2025-26 financial year, 5.36% for 2026-27 financial year, and 6.19% for 2027-28 financial year. And then Eskom then looked at the tariff that has been granted by NERSA, and then they lodged a judicial review in line with Section 10, Subsection 3 of the National Energy Regulator Act of 2004. Why they went for the judicial review is because under normal circumstances, they would then proceed with the tariff hikes that they've been given to operate, and then later they submit through what they call the regulatory clearing account, which then balances from the tariffs that they've been given versus the actual cost of generation. Now, that mechanism is no longer there. Eskom then identified the shortfall of 107 billion rand, according to Eskom. They then approached the courts to lodge a judicial review. And then NERSA themselves took a relook at their approval, and then they made a determination that actually there were errors in their calculations. There was a shortfall of about 54 billion rands. They then approached Eskom for an out-of-court settlement, and then they reached this out-of-court settlement that they will increase by 54 billion rand, which then meant that they had to spread the 54 billion rand across the two financial years from 2026 to 2027 and 2027-2028.
Professor, it's a chapter of disasters, though, as you outline this to me. And ultimately, who pays the price for these mistakes? Well, it's households and businesses, and it's inflationary.
That's correct. So the negative part of it is that already the price increases are above inflation, as per your introduction. And anything above, any price increase above inflation is bad for the economy. And we look at it from various points of view. The first point of view is the actual households that are paying and the businesses that are paying for this electricity will have to pay more for electricity, which is already more expensive. The second part is that the prices of goods and services go up because businesses basically pass on these prices to the consumers, which basically means that the households are basically hit hard almost twice. So it's not good for the economy. It's not good for the people. But on the side of Eskom, Eskom needs a cost-reflective tariff. They can't continue to supply electricity at the cost that is lower than the cost of production. That is not sustainable as well. It hit hard on the fiscus. And if they don't go for the fiscus, they won't have enough money to service their fleet, which will then basically mean that the risk of insecurity of energy supply gets higher, which basically means that we might experience load shedding if they don't recover the cost of electricity generation.
Which also raises the question, Professor, about Eskom's financial model and if it's still viable if it continues to rely on ever higher tariffs.
That is correct. So this is something that some of us have been raising for quite for the longest of time. Eskom needs to change the financial model, and they're busy now working on that. Eskom cannot only rely on tariffs. They have other businesses that they can run. If you look at Rotech Industries, for instance, they used to make things like your transformers that they would even sell to other countries in the African continent and things like that. On the tariff itself, the National Transmission Company of South Africa is now looking at a different market where they will bring in different role players and look at competition to drop the electricity prices or to basically ensure that we don't have these double-digit increases going forward. So they are looking at that. The Minister of Electricity and Energy himself has approached Eskom and Sanedi, the entity that I work for, to say we must start looking at the regulatory aspects and look at where can we then realize some form of savings or some form of drops in the electricity price. That work is continuing, and we hope that soon the minister will make the right announcements.
Professor Mapweli, it also raises the issue about the regulator itself, its efficacy, and whether it also needs reform.
That's correct. So in the past, the regulator used to make mistakes. Sometimes it was not necessarily mistakes. They would grant Eskom lower tariff hikes as opposed to what Eskom would have applied for. And then, like I said before, they would then rely on the regulatory clearing account to rectify the tariffs at the end of each financial year. At some point, they would make mistakes, and then the regulator would then argue that they did not make mistakes, and then it would go to court, and then Eskom will always win those cases. It indeed leads to the question whether the regulator itself is efficient enough or it's got the right people dealing with these calculations. And that's the one part of it. The other part of it is whether at the regulator there are consequences for people who make this kind of errors, or these people are allowed to make this kind of errors. Because if there are consequences, then we would have seen improvements over the years. We haven't seen improvements over the years. We don't know whether there are consequences for people who make this kind of errors. This kind of errors, they hit hard on the consumers. We all know, like I've already indicated. So they're not good for the country as well.
So how do we prevent this situation from repeating itself in the near future?
There must be a consequence management mechanism in place on the side of the regulator themselves. That's one. We've witnessed over the years that the Eskom people are very spot on when it comes to calculation of the tariffs. They never make mistakes. The regulator has got a leeway because they have the final say in terms of the actual tariffs, because they consider many aspects, including public opinion. So people must continue to participate when ESCOM apply for these tariff hikes. But to prevent errors of this nature, I think two things need to happen. One, NERSA needs to work closely with ESCOM when they make their determination. So once ESCOM submits the application, the NERSA colleagues must then sit with ESCOM colleagues and then look at the calculations, how they calculated the tariffs, and then agree on with them in that kind of a meet of a setting, whether there are mistakes or not. And then they must deal with that at that level. And then afterwards, the NERSA must then do their own calculations. And if there are mistakes or errors, then there must be consequence management on the side of the regulator itself. Unless you introduce consequence management, you're not going to be able to deal with these kind of things in the manner that it should be done with.
Well, whichever way you look at it, it is a very worrying situation. I've been in conversation with Professor Samson Mapwele, who's the head of the Energy Secretariat at the South African National Energy Development Institute. Professor, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, COSATU is backing the long overdue Tobacco and Electronic Delivery Systems Control Bill. It's aimed at reversing years of smoking-related harm in South Africa. The legislation, as I understand it, tackles everything from plain packaging and sales restrictions to banning smoking near children. And it's responding to the scourge that claims around 30,000 lives annually while leaking over R1 billion from our healthcare system and nearly 1% of GDP in lost productivity. But with vested interests lining up and the illicit trade at a record high, I guess the question is, can this bill stand strong and enforce real change? Well, an organization entering that debate is COSATU, as I've just mentioned, and I'm in conversation now with Matthew Parks. Matthew, let's break all of this down, and I'm curious to know why organized labor sees tobacco control as part of its mandate. Many would expect health groups maybe to lead this debate.
Well, I think for us, there's many critical issues. One is the health of workers, the families. Secondly, is also revenue that it's owed to the state, the sin tax regime. And of course, there's also jobs in the legal trade as well. The bill provides many useful interventions building upon the existing 1995 law that was put in place under the Mandela administration. So to deal with the issue of smoking in the workplace, because why should workers who don't smoke have their health affected? It prohibits smoking in front of children for obvious reasons. It also seeks to reduce the attractiveness to non-smokers, especially young people, by dealing with the issue of advertising, not allowing you to display tobacco products, including vaping, in stores and so forth. You have to ask for it over the counter. So those are useful things to try to kind of reduce the amount of people smoking and so forth. Mm. Our fear is that the bill doesn't go far enough to deal with the issue of the explosion of illicit tobacco. We've seen in the past few years, exacerbated by the COVID-19 period, that the illicit trade, which has occupied now about 70% of the market, it sells for an average about a quarter of the price of legal cigarettes, and that creates a crisis for many areas. It threatens the collapse of the legal industry and those companies who actually pay the taxes, abide by the law, etc. It threatens to actually see more people smoking because it's a quarter of the price, and we've seen it in ourselves when we've done study visits to spaza shops across the Cape Flats, for example. And it's also going to mean that money owed to the state through the sin tax regime, which is used to fund healthcare and so forth, will collapse. So for us, it's a multi-pronged crisis, and we really think what's critical now is for Parliament actually to use this opportunity to strengthen the bill, to require the state to deal with tracking and tracing of products, and to really deal with illicit trade. And I think for us, that's a critical issue right now, because otherwise, if we don't do that, then everything else will become academic around tobacco control.
Matthew Parks, I can't help but wonder whether the illicit trade has become almost too entrenched now, part of the norm. And it doesn't matter what legislation you apply, it's going to be very difficult to monitor, control, and ultimately police and prosecute.
And that's increasingly becoming the crisis, Jeremy. SARS lost a court case about a year ago when they had installed CCTV cameras at a tobacco warehouse, and the company affected claimed that as a violation of privacy. Who would imagine that cigarettes need privacy? But I think for us, and the court said, well, SARS doesn't have the legal power. So here's the opportunity when you have finally got the bill before Parliament to address that legal vacuum. Let's require SARS to be obliged to do it. That'll capacitate them to do so, but also enables Parliament to hold SARS, law enforcement, etc., accountable to say, well, the law says this. What are you doing about it? But if you don't act, then we might as well kiss goodbye any sense of control over the tobacco industry. We must prepare to see money lost to the state, and must prepare to see that those legally abiding companies and those jobs will go. And of course, we must prepare to accept that young people smoke in increasing numbers. And I think that's not a battle we can afford to walk away from. It is going to be very difficult, but with all of our challenges are always very difficult. But I think for us, as long as we begin to make progress, when we deal with the issue, that's good enough. It'll take time, but we have to start somewhere.
Matthew, you don't find yourself perhaps in a slightly contradictory situation here. On the one hand, COSATU fights for jobs, and the tobacco industry is, in one way or another, a jobs enabler. How do you reconcile that with backing a bill that ultimately is going to shrink parts of the tobacco industry?
So I think for us, we have a coalition of interests right now between the health lobby, be it government or NGOs, the legally abiding industry, which has jobs, and of course ourselves. We're interested in both vantage points. We want to see workers being healthy, but we also do want to protect jobs in this economy with a 43% unemployment rate. But right now, if you don't deal with illicit trade, we are going to see those jobs go anyway. In the manufacturing plants, in the distribution industry, and even the jobs which are funded through the fiscus, through the sin tax regime. So that's why we're saying right now we've got to deal with the issue of illicit trade, because those are essentially criminal syndicates. They don't pay any taxes. They undermine legally compliant companies. They undermine legal jobs. And I think for us we have to deal with it. Otherwise, we are going to see those jobs being lost in the legal industry. And that's something we just can't afford. So I think for us right now, it's a coalition of interests all speaking to the issue of the need to deal with illicit trade.
Do you think there is the will and the appetite to deal with the illicit trade?
I think from SARS's side, there has been the will, but they need to be legally empowered. They also need, obviously, to be given the resources too. And I think SARS has shown how you can rebuild the city, how you can deal with criminal elements through tax collection. That's, by the way, that's a model that the US took in the 1930s against Al Capone when he was a gangster running amok in Chicago. I think you hit people, criminals, where it hurts, in the pocketbook. But if you don't do it, then we must accept that we're going to become an increasingly lawless society. And I think that, again, that's not a fight we can afford to walk away from. It's not going to be easy. But one of the positive things is that if we collaborate with a legally compliant industry, they have useful intelligence about the illicit trade, and they can provide practical information about how to deal with it, suggestions and so forth. And I think that's what we're trying to build here, the complementary partnership between the state, civil society around health objectives, but also the legally binding industry around jobs and dealing with illicit trade. But again, the illicit industry is not, these are not angels. These are people with deep pockets. They're willing to buy politicians. They're willing to bribe officials, be it SARS or the police. And so we really need that joint partnership of government, business, civil society, and labor to deal with a real threat to our health regime, and of course to our taxes, and of course to our legally binding companies.
That's fundamentally the big problem, because there is the issue of weak enforcement and maybe political will, but ultimately it would seem to me that vested interests, as you've outlined, are winning this battle.
They are increasingly, and it's quite scary. The explosion last half a decade—it's really galloping, but it's never too late to intervene. But if you don't do something, then of course we can't complain afterwards when it happens. We think there is space, and you have to target the distribution centers, the warehouses, and so forth. That's where you begin to start. Most of our tobacco is manufactured or packaged locally. Of course, there is some smuggling in through our borders as well. That again speaks to the need to empower SARS, the Border Management Authority, and so forth. But you have to do it. The amount of money lost to the state is about 30 billion rand. So that's equal to a 2% VAT hike. So it's a significant amount of money. We may not be able to recover all of it. That's fine. Even if we just recover half of it, that would give significant breathing space to the state. It'll mean the state can hire more doctors and nurses, can invest more in the public healthcare institutions to deal with the causes of smoking. And again, we need to really question our lifestyles as a society. When you lose 30,000 people a year for smoking, that's something we shouldn't be just continuing to normalize. We should be also saying beyond the bill, how do we engage in consumer education? How do we make young people aware of the risk of smoking? And that's part of the bill as well, is to say we need to have on the packaging of cigarette packs, very clear information about what lung cancer does to you, how it's related to smoke, what is the visual graphics of it. But again, we need to really begin to change society for the better. We shouldn't just continue to normalize what are really unacceptable behavior patterns.
Thank you very much indeed. From Kasatu, Matthew Parks, always appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africans are moving more and more of their money offshore, but many are parking it in low-yielding deposits that don't necessarily keep pace with inflation. Now, the rand is steadily losing ground. There is political uncertainty, and local growth, I don't need to tell you, is barely ticking over. So obviously, investors are looking for smarter ways to diversify. And one of those options gaining some attention is private debt. But is it really the answer? Well, let's try and find out. I'm in conversation now with Dino Zuccolo, who is head of Investor Solutions at Westbrook Alternative Asset Management. Dino, a very warm welcome to you. I don't need to tell you that South Africans have been diversifying offshore for years. What is different, do you think, about the urgency that we're seeing right now?
Yeah, Jeremy, thanks so much for having me. We have conversations with South African clients a lot, and I think those conversations are always sort of centered around the same thing, which is over the course of the last pretty long while now, there has been increasing levels of concern amongst South Africans around the degree to which we are invested locally. I mean, one must remember that we as South Africa are less than 1% of total global market capitalization, and yet most South Africans have more than 50% of their wealth invested in this country. So what we've seen over the last sort of long time now, probably more than 10, 20, even more years, is a big theme of South Africans externalizing their money. And you can take, as you know, more than the normal million rand offshore each year, up to 11 million if you can get a single discretionary allowance to do so. And then the problem is the money hits offshore in hard currency. And suddenly you find yourself in a situation where in a bank account, for example, in pounds, you're earning probably less than 2%. In a fixed deposits account with maybe a 6 month notice, you're earning 3, 3.5%. And you've got UK inflation at 3.8%. And so externalizing is great, but once the money goes offshore, you need to invest in such a way as A, not to lose that money, and B, to keep up with inflation. And that, I think, is where South Africans have found it to be challenging over the last while.
And Dino, those numbers that you've just given me seem irrational, but investors are still opting for that option. What's the kind of behavior quotient there? Why are they doing that? What are they afraid of?
The issue, Jeremy, is access. So you've moved your money offshore and you want to invest it. The logical thing that most of us would do is you would invest it in equities. You'd buy listed equity shares. The issue is that conventional wisdom would suggest that you should never invest 100% of your wealth into high-risk equities that bounce around all the time and have mark-to-market adjustments. They can do well, they can do badly. So if you don't want to run material capital loss risk, but you still want to make a return, your options are limited. And especially if you're on the other side of the world, but you live here in South Africa, it's very difficult to get access. And that's something that we at Westbrook are working really hard to change, which is how do you provide what I'd call a South African connected capital base with access to private market opportunities, which are one of the key global investment trends of the world at the moment, but when you're based here locally.
So private debt, maybe start with a definition and then tell me if it's really safer or just less transparent than equities and bonds.
Yeah, so private debt, Jeremy, in very simple terms, is where somebody other than a bank makes a loan. And in 2008, we had global financial crisis. Following GFC, there were obviously a host of irresponsible lending practices. And so the response was Basel and a whole host of regulation placed on the banks around what they need to do when they extend a loan. And so the response by a lot of the banks globally was to say, okay, well, now making a loan is really expensive for us. And so in order to make it profitable, we need to do bigger loans. And so generally offshore, we see that the banks don't really want to get out of bed for making of a loan of less than, let's say, 20 million pounds. Now that's 500 million rand. And that dearth or gap in the market has increasingly been filled by private lenders. So where a bank raises predominantly its money from deposit holders, and those deposit holders can go draw their money from the ATM whenever they want, a private credit fund takes investors and they lock them in for a period of time. But the advantage of that is that you can now go as a non-bank lender. You can be quicker, better, faster, to use the old analogy. So you can provide smaller loans with greater complexity quicker, and fill a need for an entrepreneur who's looking to grow their business in a much more effective way than what the traditional banks can. And by being able to do that, we believe very strongly that we are able to achieve what I'd call asymmetric returns. So a return where the level of risk that you need to take is lower than the return that you should be achieving for that unit of risk.
But how liquid are these investments, particularly when investors want their money back quickly?
They are less liquid, and that is the key drawback to alternative investments. So if you look, for example, in our Yield Plus fund, which is our sort of flagship private credit fund in the UK, it's got a 7-year track record, £180 million under management. You can invest there on a quarterly basis, but you need to give us 6 months' notice if you want to get your money out. And the way that we facilitate that liquidity, so in other words, how do we pay an investor out when they want their money, is we make lots of loans, 40 to 50 in general, and they are constantly sort of on a hamster wheel in our world. So there's always a series of loans repaying and then being extended again. But the advantage for that, Jeremy, is you get where, you know, in a 6-month fixed deposit, you'd be getting 3 to 3.5%, as I mentioned earlier. In Yield Plus, you're getting 7 to 8. And then, of course, because we are a private markets manager, you can get cleverer with things like tax. And so when you incorporate tax, we can generate for a client a return that is up to 3 times post-tax amount that you'd be getting in the more traditional structures.
So what advice would you give to investors when it comes to assessing their own personal risk in that regard?
I think that the starting point, Jeremy, is that you should have a great financial advisor. And any good financial advisor will have recognized the fact that the old wisdom of 60-40, so 60% we always used to allocate to equities, 40% to listed bonds, it doesn't work anymore. And that's because the correlation between equities and bonds has become very strongly positive. And so increasingly, we are seeing people advocate for a level of inclusion in the portfolios for alternatives, maybe something closer to a 40-30-30, where 30% gets allocated to alternatives. Now, alternatives come with more complexity, more risk, and as I mentioned, liquidity are the downsides. You know, there's no such thing in life as a free lunch. And so if you have a really high-quality wealth advisor, they'll already be talking to us, they'll understand the risks, and they'll be well-equipped to give you the advice that you need to future-proof your portfolio for the realities of the world we live in today.
Providing there's not a crisis, because surely in a crisis, all correlations start to spike.
Absolutely. I mean, at some point, everything is correlated. It's just to what degree. One of the things that I find particularly appealing about alternatives is that, you know, you might be invested in a property stock in the United States and a war breaks out in the Middle East and suddenly the valuation of your investment moves. Now, that may or may not have anything to do with the fundamentals of the underlying investment you've made. For me, one of the beauties of alternatives or private market assets is that your return is much more closely linked to the fortunes of that investment or that property on that street in that area. And so if you invest with a quality manager who's financially aligned, who's got a long track record of success, and ultimately who you can trust, and maybe in future conversations we can talk about how one due diligences their asset manager in this instance. If you can find a good asset manager who ticks all of those boxes, I think that you can take away some of the sort of the market risk or some of the more systemic risk and get a return profile much more linked to the quality of your asset manager.
Thank you very much for talking to me. That's Dino Zuccolo, who is Head of Investor Solutions at Westbrook Alternative Asset Management.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, for years, there's been a perception that Apple and Microsoft just don't play well together. But in today's digital workspace, that divide may be more myth than reality. With more South African SMEs turning to Apple devices, what does this mean really to run a Mac in a Microsoft-driven world? And what are the opportunities and perhaps the hidden challenges for business owners? I want to explore that in a little more detail with Lance van der Molen from iStore Business. Lance, a very warm welcome. And as I've just said, many business owners still believe that Mac and Microsoft don't mix. Where does that myth come from? And why do you think it's outdated?
Well, I think it was a very intended thing from an Apple point of view. If you recall, in the early 2000s, there was the PC guy, the Mac guy. It was a great marketing campaign, a great advert at the time. That myth has continued on and over the
almost
last
like
few
the
years.
Coke and Pepsi
yes,
debate, right?
Yeah, Coke and Pepsi debate. When we look at where we are at the moment, it's very much I'm a producer guy. I produce output, digital output, whether that is an Excel report or if that is a video. So we're starting to see that the acceptance of a platform is the norm. The productivity output is what people are being measured by. Microsoft themselves have invested heavily in making sure that the tools that they produce work exceptionally on the Apple platform. So much so that we see Microsoft on keynotes with Apple and Apple on keynotes with Microsoft when they launch products. Every one of the current Microsoft products are launched on Apple and Microsoft at exactly the same time. So we've seen that adoption and acceptance by the industry leaders.
So no real worries there for SMEs?
Not from an SME point of view at all. Everything works perfectly. In fact, what we do find is some of the applications are perhaps sometimes a bit more intuitive on the Apple platform. That's just because of the Apple interfaces.
So let me ask you this. Security is a hot button issue. I'm sure that you would agree with me. Are there reassurances that you can give SMEs that Macs align with Microsoft's compliance and governance standards? I mean, that's critical to the peace of mind for any business, isn't it?
Yes, it is. What we like to promote is very much a get as much as you can out of the Apple platform. What people don't necessarily understand is that Apple ships with antivirus, anti-malware as part of the solution. What we like to do is enable that within the Microsoft world. So we do a layered security approach with Microsoft. Microsoft Defender, a great product that comes with the Microsoft Productivity Suite, works perfectly with the Apple environment. I was pleasantly surprised a few years ago dealing with Microsoft with an Apple. We raised a security risk with Microsoft, and within an hour they had responded. They had updated their security addresses around the world, and they pushed that out. Mm. So they respond in the same way that they would on any of the other product sets. And from an SME point of view, the choice really is around what should I use for my end users and my workers.
Lance, some owners might fear, security aside, that switching to Mac could disrupt existing systems. It's critical that that transition happens seamlessly.
Yes. What I said earlier around the fact that people now view a productivity worker, it's no longer a Mac guy or a PC guy, it's no longer a knowledge worker. It's about how much productivity I can get in an hour. Part of the programs that we do offer is that ability for people to switch, the switcher training, the acceptance of those kind of things. So yes, we do see some hesitancy amongst some of the more PC-based people. But if you use an iPhone or an Android device, the transition is very, very easy into the Apple ecosystem.
Let me push you a little bit further on that. For cost-conscious SMEs, how do they weigh upfront investment in a Mac against longer-term gains in productivity and reliability? What kind of sums do they need to do in their head?
5, 6, 7 years ago, we were really pushing hard on the total cost of ownership. We're very proud of the fact that Apple's been able to launch the MacBook Air for the last 5 years at under $1,000 every year. While we've seen an increase in the PC prices of between 10 and 15% per year. So right out of the bat at the moment, tag for tag, Apple is actually cheaper. So much so that on a good knowledge worker device, we're looking at between 3 and 5,000 Rand entry level, a Mac is cheaper. So that myth of Apple being more expensive is no longer an issue when you actually start looking at the tag prices for the devices.
And Lance, in a hybrid work environment such as we operate in right now, where staff are often mixing devices and platforms, Mac obviously needs to fit into that blended reality.
In the Microsoft world, that all is linked via what we call Azure ID, the old Active Directory. That username and password that you had to log on to your work email is the same username and password you would log on to your Mac. As part of the modernization of device management and identity, Microsoft has embraced that extensively. So when I'm using a Mac and I see you sitting here with a Windows device, I'm quite capable of sharing things with you via Teams or email, via Outlook, etc. The difference being those are all cloud services now. So it doesn't really make much difference around what your endpoint is.
You'll agree with me that tech choices, again, for small businesses can often be intimidating. It's also beyond the initial purchase. It's the support after the fact, so to speak.
From an iStore point of view, we're very excited about our tech desks that we've got at all of our 42 locations around South Africa, where we are able to assist and help a small business in that transition, get them up and running very quickly, move them from their existing tech stack onto the Apple ecosystem. Once on the Apple ecosystem, we are able to enable some really nice functionality Apple calls Apple Continuity, which then allows you to do work on your phone, on your iPad or on your Mac. So if you start an email on your iPhone and you suddenly realize it's going to be longer than what you expected, you can put your iPhone down and continue exactly where you were on your Mac.
Just a final one. A lot of, again, small businesses might see choosing a Mac simply as a tech upgrade. Convince me that it's a strategic move for growth-minded SMEs.
Okay. If you look at the cost of a device nowadays and the longevity out of the device, when you're buying at the top of the cycle, i.e. when a device is released from an Apple point of view, we're seeing at least 6-7 years of operating system support. What does that mean? It means you can use that device for at least 7 years within your organization without worrying about your security updates, your operating system updates. Even then, we still see value in those devices. We've got a great trade-in program where we are able to trade those devices in and show significant value at the end of the life cycle of those devices. So strategically, it's not just a upfront cost of saying, I'm going to use it for 4 years. You can recycle that device throughout your organization. We see people who are using devices for trainees, entry-level people that have been using for 5-6 years.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Lance van der Molen from iStore Business. Appreciate you coming in today. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.